On Friday, when I wrote this sermon, I did something that I thought I was going to do a lot when I moved to Oakland, but that I've never actually done. And that is, I got on the BART, and I went over to San Francisco, and I wrote my sermon in a cafe in San Francisco. And if you will allow me a little bit of regional snobbery, let me say that while I love San Francisco for lots of reasons, when it comes to coffee shops, San Francisco doesn't hold a candle to Oakland or Berkeley. I actually was in San Francisco for a rather pedestrian reason. I was there because I needed a new watch band, and the brand of watch I wear has a retail outlet near the Powell Street BART station. So I used Yelp to find a cafe within walking distance to the watch store, and following the reviews on Yelp, which promised a cafe that had great coffee and a good place to work, I ended up on Taylor Street, where I found the place with a line out the door. And as I looked through the window, I could see two things. First of all, I could see that it was indeed a beautiful space. There was a lot of polished chrome, and there was a big chalkboard all over the wall that pithy things were written on. And it also had a nice menu up there, which looked kind of compelling. I also saw that the whole outfit was about the size of my office. There was no seating to speak of. So whoever said on Yelp that it was a good place for working must have been referring to the experience of the baristas. So whatever, I kept walking and passing places that were similarly small and stuffed to the gills with patrons getting their coffees and croissants to go. When I finally found a cafe that was hospitable to people with computers, it was empty. And this was not the fault of the establishment, mind you. It had great coffee and a friendly barista, and it had a sweet vibe. But apparently, cafes like that are an Oakland thing. Apparently, people in the city do coffee differently than we do. Of course, the problem might have been the neighborhood. If I'd been over in Little Italy, I'm sure I could have found something, probably a place infused by the life force of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who at 100 years old apparently still has a life force to offer. But I was near Union Square and on the edge of the Tenderloin, a neighborhood that I would have avoided back in the 1980s when I spent time living and studying in San Francisco. In fact, the first cafe I visited, with its polished chrome and pithy chalkboard, it was next door to Glide Memorial Church, a congregation which for decades now has been a leader in providing care for the poor living in San Francisco, a city which increasingly is abandoning and excluding its poorer residents. And as much as I actually enjoyed the cafe where I ended up writing my sermon, I was a little disappointed that I didn't get to write this sermon at a gleamingly beautiful cafe around the corner from a long line of the city's forgotten and marginalized residents, people desperate for the kindness of charity and for the empowerment of societal transformation. Because at the heart of this morning's lesson from John is a question. And the question is this: to what extent is it okay for those who follow the teachings of Jesus to be extravagant in the pursuit of beauty? In our life of faith, what should the role of architecture and art and music played on instruments that cost a lot of money, what role should these play in our lives? Or what, for that matter, should the role of a well-made cappuccino play? Should the faithful not be satisfied with Sanka in a styrofoam cup? In this morning's lesson from John, Jesus is having a meal in the home of his friends, the siblings, Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And Mary, in the story, does an extravagantly extraordinary thing. She brings a bottle of ridiculously expensive perfume, and she breaks the bottle and pours it over Jesus' feet and wipes Jesus' feet with her hair. It's a bizarre scene. Some version of this story is told in all four of the Gospels, but In John, the story is set in the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus just after Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. And I've always assumed that Mary was in part motivated by gratitude for the gift of her brother's life, and that may be. But Mary's actions, honestly, they were kind of a weird way to express gratitude. They might have raised a few eyebrows. They probably did. First of all, there was the issue of the money. And this is recorded in the text. Judas asked why this expensive perfume was not sold and given to the poor, the money given to the poor. Judas valued the perfume at the equivalent of a year's worth of laboring wages. Now, I suspect Judas was exaggerating. For one thing, the gospel writers often use exaggeration to make a point. For another, I don't know a lot of men who know the first thing about how much a bottle of women's perfume costs. I'm willing to bet that the males of our species really haven't changed that much in the last 2,000 years, but I digress. The act was stunning because it was financially extravagant, and it's safe to say that the perfume had an overwhelming effect on the house. Of course, the gospel writers only mention the financial question raised by Mary's display of beauty, probably because the other implications of Mary's actions were an elephant in the room nobody really wanted to talk or even think about. Mary was touching a man who was not her husband or brother. And not only was she showing him her hair, she was wiping her feet with his hair, which I'm guessing was suggestive and almost unimaginably fraught with tension and overtone and entendre, which means it was scandalous. But it was also beautiful because it was a courageous, outrageous, extravagant display of affection. And that made it beautiful. Even if it was uncomfortable, it was beautiful. But even as we acknowledge the beauty of Mary's act, the sentiment expressed by Judas that the perfume should have been sold and the proceeds given to the poor, that remains a challenge we face every time a church does anything that costs money and doesn't have any direct material benefit to those who are in need. It's a question that remains with us. And historically, Presbyterians have placed a high value on simplicity, some would say parsimony. In fact, our Book of Order has a list of what it calls the essential tenets of the Reformed faith, and one of those essential tenets is that we are to practice what the Book of Order calls a faithful stewardship that shuns ostentation and seeks proper use of the gifts of God's creation. And we've always pursued this kind of simplicity because we want to make sure that at least it looks like we care about the poor, even if we don't. This rejection of ostentation can get a little bit internalized. I've internalized it. I'll tell you a little secret. Many of you know that I really like the city of Geneva in Switzerland. And I love the city of Geneva for lots of reasons. But one of the things I like about Geneva is that in Geneva, you can look at all sorts of fancy watches in store windows. Swiss watches are beautiful. It is such a pleasure to look at them, but I know I could never wear one. Even if I could afford to buy such a watch, because I'm a Presbyterian minister, I couldn't wear one. It would be professional malpractice on several level for me to wear a watch as a Presbyterian minister. So I wear a swatch. It's a compromise. It's made in Switzerland, but it's also inexpensive. And they have a store in San Francisco where I can get a new watch band. But again, I digress, because this passage really isn't about watches. So I'm going to spend the rest of my sermon applying the challenge of this morning's lesson to an issue that I think every congregation faces just about, and that is the issue of our buildings. And I want to talk about buildings because building and maintaining our buildings is the most expensive thing that congregations do. Buildings are what make us most visible in our communities, and we probably argue more about buildings than we argue about anything else. You know, even in very traditional churches, it's easier to add a fourth person to the Trinity than it is to remodel the sanctuary. I know you all would accept a fourth person to the Trinity, but not everybody would.
And I think for a lot of us, the challenge of this morning's gospel lesson has nothing to do with expensive perfume being used to anoint an itinerant miracle-working rabbi. Rather, when it comes to acts of extravagant beauty, the challenge for most people of faith today has to do with our buildings. And I want to talk about church buildings because I realize that we also have to have conversations and we have to struggle with, you know, the personal use of money, and we have to ask whether it's okay to wear an expensive watch when people are hungry or drive a fancy car or whatever. This morning's lesson from John really isn't a story that deals with those kinds of issues. Rather, it's a story about using something really expensive to do something beautiful in praise and in honor of God, which is different from personal expenses. It may be that Mary's initial purchase of the $30,000 worth of perfume, that might have been questionable, but notice that no one ever really challenges her for owning the perfume. They only challenge her for using the perfume in honor of Jesus, to the glory of God. And so it is that when congregations face questions about how we use money, it usually has to do with spending it on our buildings and our property. We ask, is it okay for congregations to spend large sums on beautiful worship spaces? This is a question that a lot of us ask when we visit cathedrals, right? Whether you're in Salisbury or in Oakland, you have to ask, is it okay to spend all this money on a church building? And I know that it's a question that this congregation wrestled with when you renovated this sanctuary 12 years ago or whenever it was, 2006, right? And no doubt we're going to have to face this again because we're about to remodel the front. We're about to redo our entryway, the bits of our property that look across Temescal Creek and out onto Thornhill Drive. Is it okay for congregations to spend great amounts of money so that we can worship God surrounded by beauty? Well, my answer to that question is yes. And there are three reasons for this. One is philosophical, one is economic, and the other has to do with my commitment to social justice. The philosophical answer to why churches should spend money on buildings is that beauty and goodness and truth are all interconnected. This is an observation that was first documented by the ancient Greek philosophers, and I think it makes sense. The idea is that if we surround ourselves with beauty, we will be less patient with ugliness in the world, and we will be less likely to countenance lies and deception. Of course, that only works if we understand that connection, if we commit ourselves to the work of building intentional threads that tie truth and beauty and goodness to each other. But in that work of understanding the relationship between beauty, truth, and goodness, it serves no one if we are ignoring beauty or diminishing the importance of beauty. And beauty doesn't have to be expensive. That's an important thing to remember. It doesn't have to be expensive or extravagant. And here I'm beginning my economic argument. You know, I sort of wonder what it would have looked like if Mary had anointed Jesus' feet with, you know, a less expensive bottle of perfume, the kind you can get at Target. I don't know. It might have been just as good. Some of the most amazing worship spaces I have experienced are not extravagant, but they are well thought out. They are well designed. I think our own sanctuary is an example of this, as is College Avenue Presbyterian Church, which was designed by Julia Morgan. It's a simple yet achingly beautiful sanctuary. And if you ever are on the Palos Verdes Peninsula in Southern California, stop by the Wayfarers Chapel. It is a Frank Lloyd Wright designed building that is most remarkable for what it isn't, which is to say overbuilt. I've never been in a building that made me feel less like I was in a building. But I'm even a fan of big, expensive cathedrals because every time a church decides to build a building, what happens is that the members of the church collect money from wealthy patrons and they spend that money to hire workers. Provided the churches aren't being built by slaves, which unfortunately happens some of the time, particularly it happened in the United States. But cathedrals represent a huge transfer of wealth from the wealthy landed class to the laboring class. I'm not an expert on such things, but as I understand it, the cities in Europe with cathedrals are the cities where the European middle class was born. Building those massive churches over the course of sometimes hundreds of years created a class of skilled workers that brought generations of people out of poverty. The same is true today. You know, when the Diocese of Oakland built their extravagant cathedral downtown, that provided a lot of jobs with good pay for working class people. Even here at Montclair Presbyterian Church, whenever we do building projects, we employ people and we try to pay them well. It's not charity, but it is justice. And this leads me to my third reason for supporting the building of beautiful worship spaces. Justice isn't just a matter of financial security. There's also this. It's an observation that comes from the popular philosopher Alain de Botton, who, by the way, is an atheist, but he respects religion for our worship spaces, for our architecture. What he says is that when churches are built beautifully, it means that poor people have the opportunity to experience great art without having to pay money to get into a museum. Here in Oakland, someone who's poor, someone who might not have the money or the time to visit museums, or someone who doesn't live in a beautiful home, someone who doesn't have the money, the resources to go out to hear live music, that person can get all of those things by going to a church. Whether he comes to Montclair Presbyterian Church, or she goes to the Roman Catholic Cathedral, or they go to College Avenue, or any number of amazing churches in our city, a person who might not otherwise get to enjoy the beauty of architecture or the energy of live music can go to church on Sunday, and he can be in an aesthetically pleasing space. She can interact with art in the form of stained glass or other liturgical expressions. They can hear, you know, Marcia play the organ, or a choir sings, or maybe Rich on the violin, or the Barrel House Band if they come on Easter. If you believe, as I do, that artistic expression is part of what makes us human, if you believe, as I do, that an interaction with creative beauty is part of what makes life joyful, and if you believe, as I do, that human dignity and joy should not be reserved for wealthy people, then we have a responsibility to be like Mary, to be extravagant in our expression of and in our creation of beauty. And when we do, we need to throw open the doors of the church to welcome everyone who would experience the beauty of what we do here. But we still have the question. What about meeting people's immediate needs? Providing artistic beauty is fine, but what about food? How can anyone enjoy nice architecture on an empty stomach? Jesus reminds us that the poor will always be with us. And the implication is that care for the poor is perpetual work for us as people of faith. The direct help of those in need must not be neglected. And few churches are better at the work of helping poor people than is Glide Memorial Church, which I passed as I was looking for a place to write this sermon in San Francisco. Nobody in our region does it better than Glide Memorial Church. And here's the thing. Glide Memorial Church has a really beautiful church building. In fact, I expect that the beauty of the Glide Memorial Church building is part of what made folks know that they were a church in the first place. The beauty of that building is part of why folks went to them seeking help. The beauty of their building is part of what makes them a beacon of hope. I think that the truth that Jesus conveys in this morning's lesson from John is this. We don't have to choose between creating beauty and caring for the poor. Both are necessary, and they are not mutually exclusive. We need to do both. And we can. We can do both. May we all be extravagant in the pursuit of beauty. And may our extravagance transform and heal the world. And may our extravagance bring joy and hope to all the children of God who call this world their home. Amen.